Dennis Schemmelt, formerly evaluator of the SHP project, then known as History 1316, latterly director of that project, and then co-director of the Cambridge A-Level History Project. That's probably it.
Thank you, Dennis. Could you tell me a bit about your career background before you became involved with Schools Council History Project?
Yes, I was simply a teacher. Then had a phone call inviting me to Leeds University to discuss a possible job. The discussion turned out to be an interview, so I ended up on the Institute of Education at Leeds. And History 1316 project came to Leeds, and they were looking for an evaluator who was an historian and numerate, or able to crunch data. And I was asked if I would be interested and said yes.
So they knew already that you were interested in that sort of area of things. Were you an economic historian?
Well, history of ideas, really. But at the Institute, I was mainly just on dealing with the postgraduates on the various diploma, MA courses, etc. So not working specifically in the area of history education at all when I was at Leeds. So I was quite glad to get back to doing some history.
So how did you come to get the job of evaluator? Why did they think you were especially suited to that? You done evaluations of other projects?
No, but I was involved in the research at the Institute, the Carnegie project, and I was doing some statistics and research methodology teaching, and it was simply they wanted an historian who could crunch numbers. And I was on the spot, so it was serendipity.
So you
was very lucky.
You were at the Carnegie Institute in Leeds then?
Well, it was the Institute of Education.
Was it?
At Leeds.
Yeah.
Before, they had a School of Education, which taught PGC, and the Institute of Education, which did postgraduate, higher degrees and diplomas and research contracts.
And that was part of the University of Leeds?
Part of the University of Leeds.
Because originally Schools Council was based there, wasn't it?
It was.
Yes, before it moved here.
With David Sylvester, who was the PGC e-tutor in the School of Education.
So you knew him as a colleague anyway?
Yeah.
So what can you say about the team that actually worked on History 1316 in the 1970s? So 72 that you actually got together to do this?
Yes, I didn't join until 74.
Right, so David had already been working on it for a couple
it
of
been
years.
Yes, it was already launched. The team, well, the heart and soul and the brains, it was all David Sylvester. And colleagues were a little bit, Peter Wenham was there, Bill Harrison, Aileen Plummer, they were the original team members. Some skepticism, and Peter Wenham dropped out and was replaced by Tony Boddington. I think he was much more on message or much more positive about it all.
Mm. It was a bold thing to undertake, wasn't it?
Yes, and I think David really forced it through, and the team only slowly grew to understand it, and some of them slowly grew to believe in it. And I must confess that when I first looked at it, I thought this might work very well for grammar schools, but I didn't expect at all that it would work for comprehensive or secondary modern. And so we all learnt a great deal. And on this, I'll say that I learned a lot about history that I didn't know.
About history teaching or about history?
About history education. And about history. So I never looked terribly seriously at Collingwood before the project. Mm. And or about Galley, you know, sort of genetic explanation. So it was David who introduced, I read that sort of stuff as a result of David Sylvester's basic idea. And when I started looking in schools and working out how we were going to test what sort of impact this was having, then I learned a lot about how kids are thinking, which I'd not learned in the classroom.
So even though you'd been involved in teacher education before that?
Well, exactly. But the teacher education I'd been involved in was not PGCE. But I'd been a teacher before that. And all the team members had been teachers. But they didn't understand it fully, so they learned they were in the same boat. So really there was only one man who understood it to begin with.
That was David.
And that was David Sylvester.
So where do you think his ideas had come from then?
Simply, I think, from very long experience as a PGC tutor. And I think it's the standard thing that once you're out of the classroom, but you're carrying on going into the classroom, you see what different teachers do, you see how different schools work, you see how different groups of kids operate. You tend to, I think, it's common for people to say that they learn more when they've left a classroom or left a single classroom about how to do it. I was joined by a colleague, Joe Scott, who was a lot older than me at that time. He was in his 50s when he joined the project, much later. And he always used to say, because he'd been a project teacher, but he always used to say that after 18 months at the university and then here, when we moved, that he'd learnt more about how to teach and about the subject than in all his years teaching.
Why do you think that is?
I think because you see a lot of different possibilities and you're not sort of trapped on the inside. As a PGC tutor, you go around and you just see so many different things, and it does expand horizons. You start to think out of the box, the original box being the classrooms that you were originally teaching in. And you tend to think that what the kids do that you're teaching is what all they can do. And you know, but also we're asking them different sorts of questions, because we had to devise, if you like, fair tests. So we had to move beyond content, which the Schools History Project people were doing, and we're comparing them with the outcomes from modern world history, from socio and economic history. We had to find content which was foreign to all and look for transfer.
So that's the evaluation.
That was the evaluation.
Yes. In the opening paragraphs of the evaluation in 1980, so SHP had been going about 8 years.
Yeah, the evaluation, that was just the evaluation, the short report. The full evaluation report was very, very much longer and disappeared and never saw the light of day again. And they just wanted something very short and user-friendly.
How was it used, the evaluation? Was it sent to schools, published and sent to them, or what?
No.
Was it for?
It was submitted to the Schools Council. And I think it's now held, the last I heard, by the CET, Council for Education Technology, which held the copyright. There was a copy that was handed over when I handed over the whole archive, but where that is now, I have no idea.
So your archive, the archive has gone to the CET, well, or to the Brotherton?
Probably the Brotherton.
Yes, I think it might be there, but yeah. I didn't see all of it when I went. In the opening paragraphs of the evaluation, the short version, you described the requirement for a journeyman project composed from existing realities and aspirations.
Yeah.
So in what ways did SCHP fulfil that requirement? Was it a journeyman project?
Well, in a way, because it people took a look at it initially. They took a look at the content. And they thought, yes, that they could relate to this. They could do it. And what looked to be novel and radical was an emphasis on sources. But that idea had been around for some time. A lot of teachers had done a lot of work on this themselves. It had simply never been incorporated into an examination course before. And so again, they thought that this was simply the system catching up with where they were. The more radical elements weren't stressed at the time, which was that people didn't understand, say, the study and development, and that the concepts of change and development were a lot more complicated than they anticipated. They didn't understand initially, very certainly didn't understand where David was coming from with his Collingwoodian philosophy. And so, I mean, empathy, we had to battle with for long and hard. People immediately connected with it because they thought this was about almost the humanistic, literary, imaginative side. And thinking and feeling as people at the time thought and felt. And they thought that was meant by Reconstruction. They hadn't read the, very few people had read any Annales history. So the Reconstruction of collective mentalities and the fact that empathy was to do with a form of explanation, trying to explain how certain things which now strike us as being illogical, irrational, stupid, or just purely brutal and unfair could be, in different circumstances, make perfect sense and seem to be totally reasonable and fair. That was, if you like, the subversive element, but where it actually connected was with the sense that, yes, we're into imagination, and imagine you are. Occasionally, well, we had difficulty getting out people out of that, unfortunately, and occasionally it sank into absurdity. We all have these tales, but I can imagine looking at some coursework. This was from Kent, and it was a girls' grammar school. And it was upstairs, you know, they'd done history around us on the on stately homes. And so all these kids were doing coursework, imagining that they were kitchen maids and serving wenches and things, servants. And we had all these slightly torrid stuff about having affairs with the young masters. And well, it wasn't the idea, but when this was explained, etc., it was again that this wasn't quite right. The next year, it was sort of crazy because she had them imagining that they were kitchen utensils.
Do you think that there are other aspects of SCHP which have been misinterpreted by teachers on the ground as well?
Well, the word to begin with, or in a sense, this misinterpretation, they were misinterpreted in a way which was common to the team. I think we all, everybody started with, yes, evidence and sources. The distinction between what was a source and what was evidence, and that these are not simply alternative terms for the same thing, was not explored and not clarified. And the notion that kids might have difficulty in making that distinction was not anticipated. And people were surprised when we found that the kids couldn't distinguish between a source and just information. So they couldn't use the source as evidence. It was just rather badly written and repetitive or contradictory.
How did you discover that?
Simply by actually getting kids to do certain exercises, and also, well, apart from the tests, we then did a lot of interviewing where the test data was used as the starting point for the interviews, and some of the test data as well to try to get, when we realised that the kids were not making sense of this, you know, when they viewed supportive one source supporting another in the waste of town, this is pure redundancy, repetition. What do we need to, they used to say, right, they've been written, what do we need to know that for? We're already told that here, you see. Or contradictory, almost gave up. Somebody's obviously lying. No. And so I can't trust this. And it was that point we realised that the kids were making assumptions, deep assumptions, that we hadn't anticipated. None of the teachers had anticipated, the team hadn't anticipated, I hadn't anticipated. So we tried to open these up. And so some of the tests were based on, you know, Kelly's construct theory, where we use certain things to elicit bipolar constructs, and then these were laddered on the standard procedure. And then we just used to try to push the kids as far as they could go to attempt to find out if they were saying things that they really believed, or why they were saying certain things. And, you know, you just stop a particular line of inquiry, a line of investigation with them, when they moved into a circle, when they just thought you were an idiot and just repeated themselves, or when they just sort of dried up and got stuck, you knew that's it. And then, you know, with various forms of analysis, we use multiple discriminant and analysis and various things. We just tested various models to see if had these various ideas, or what seemed to be atoms of ideas, clustered. And we were looking for the assumptions. So the methodology really was trying to find out what must be in the kid's head for this to be a sensible thing for them to say. Or if they can't understand what you're on about, why is this and what clues are they giving us? And we realised then that they were seeing things in a totally different way. And this led to emphasis or suggestions that really, when we're working with you know, sources of evidence, that we should, to a large extent, start with relic evidence or mute evidence, evidence which doesn't purport to say or show anything. You know, so it can't be taken as information. And therefore, they have to then start to use that or make inferences from that, which go beyond the actual thing. And it was much more difficult to get them to make a step to you know, realize that they could use a written text to support propositions or to invalidate propositions which that didn't actually say were false or didn't exactly assert. But we've then moved, you know, whereas the initial emphasis was on sources and types of source, I think we gradually realised that it was far more important for the kids to focus upon the logic of inference from certain material to certain conclusions. And we made, I think, considerable progress before the enterprise really came to a halt, as soon as we had the big reforms, as soon as school's history project went public. It did influence, I think, the national curriculum, and then it was, we had the standardisation of GCSE, then the experimentation or the investigation stopped.
Because the government had placed a framework over it, is that what you mean?
Yeah, but it was also when all the different syllabuses had to but fulfil the same basic requirements or conform with the same criteria. Although we did get a levelling up overall of the, I think, the practice in history classrooms, the floor rose, but the ceiling came down a long way. And the experimentation stopped. And under the new SHP, people stopped having to do as difficult things, anything like as difficult things, as they'd done under the old, when we were developing it and changing it.
It's interesting when you were explaining how you attempted to understand what children were making of sources. I'm wondering whether teachers found it extremely difficult to cope themselves with the problems that you described.
Yes, they did, and so did we all. And I think we were all shocked when we found, for example, that when we moved, say, to trying to emphasise relic evidence, artifactual evidence, evidence which doesn't purport to say or assert any given statements about what was going on, that teachers were still, or a lot of teachers were still, quite automatically invoking the question of how reliable is this? Well, once you can ask how authentic it is, yeah, but you can't ask how reliable it is. But they were still doing it.
Does that show they didn't really understand?
No, we didn't. But we started to move to get past that, just as we were dealing with the empathy problems. But then the whole enterprise really came to a halt with
the government
before. Yes, the GCSE and GCSE for the national curriculum.
Did people who were in the first phase, when there were these issues coming to the surface, did some of them fall away, say, we've had enough, we can't cope with the difficulties?
Yeah.
So they dropped out of the project?
Some of them did. Mm. But more tended to come in than we would have liked, in a sense. We did get a bandwagon effect, which was very unfortunate. And we did get people coming in for the wrong reasons. Yeah. And we did get advisors instructing all their, you know, schools and certain authorities that they ought to during the SHP. And I can remember offering support to those who didn't want to, because it was entirely the wrong sort of project. You can't dragoon people into something like this.
Well, one of
it's
the things
hearts and minds thing.
Yes, yeah, so one of the things you say in the evaluation is it's not an easy option.
No.
Presumably that was put in to deter people from coming for the wrong reasons.
That's right, to warn people, because it is. It was not a finished project for a start. It was an evolving product, we were all finding out. And I think the team made mistakes. I think David Sylvester would probably admit now that, for example, that the mantra of, you know, the distinction between primary and secondary sources, which was pushed to begin with, was a big mistake. Because people, why? You know, what's the point of this? Why should kids know this? They got the wrong idea of what the distinction was between a primary and a secondary source. And we had people being taught, you know, that a primary source is necessarily one that is actually produced at the time by people who are witness to or participant in the events described. And a secondary source is necessarily produced sometime after the event by people who weren't there. But those are incidental features of the distinction. They're not the logical, they're not the diacritical features. And they're not why the distinction matters. And the distinction really only matters once you get to, I think, to universities, because, you know, a secondary source is simply one that is based upon, wholly or in part, based upon primary sources to which we have access. And therefore we can use them to check on, to make an evaluation of the secondary source in terms of how those sources are used. And that's the only point of the distinction. Mm. But since it was introduced, this error was spun, which was not only, it wasn't a case of simplification of an idea, it was a wrong idea that served no useful purpose. It just obfuscated the whole business of how we actually find out, how we decide whether we're entitled to say one thing rather than another, or more particularly, if we've got several possibilities, you know, all of which are admissible to some degree, how we determine which one is the stronger case pro tem, which is as much a matter of logic as the available sources. So, you know, we found out, we discovered, none of us spotted, I didn't spot that this was the primary secondary source distinction was both unnecessary for this level of history, school history, or that it was going to be damaging. It was something that we just discovered en route.
It may have been one of those handy simplifications that teachers are always looking for.
I know.
And it does bring you back to this understanding of the philosophy of school's history project. I mean, on the one hand, you call it a journeyman project. On the other hand, it did have a philosophical basis.
Very much, very strong.
What would you say is the essence of the philosophical basis?
That history should be, that school history is only going to be valuable when taught as a form of knowledge, you know, the Hurstian model. That you know, historians have particular ways of validating concepts, validating their propositions, and of offering explanations of varying kinds, which are particular to the discipline and which differ epistemologically and procedurally from those of other forms. And it's not a hybrid area of inquiry like education or engineering. It is a form, an empirical form like physics, only at the other end perhaps of the empirical spectrum.
The problem may have arisen, I wonder, I'm just suggesting this to you, is that looking back, a number of teachers, as you said, were interested in using sources, but what you find perhaps before SHP is they're using them to decorate their lessons, if you like, to add interest sparkle. And that's not what SHP was about.
No, not at all. Another thing, part of that problem as well, was that to make it a journeyman project, what had very few people, for example, even on the team, read Galley or Collingwood, despite David's prompting. No, I hadn't read them before, I did the project, but other colleagues didn't. I think very few colleagues in school read them, which is where, you know, the emphasis upon the conceptual, the second order concepts, what are now called second order concepts, or the meta concepts, was passed off as dealing with skills which had the journeyman ring. And so people were talking about skills. Now, it didn't really matter as what they would call those things, as long as what they were doing was good. And you know, very often it was very good, and it certainly got better. I think one good a instance of the of this is, if you like, the study in development, which was, I think, a novel idea. Yes, people had done these long themes before, but David picked medicine, which was an inspired choice. It had human interest, and it was a technological area which had great significance, you know, socially and humanly. But initially, it took quite a while before we were able to get people to have mastered the line of development, or even to understand the line of development.
Because most of them wouldn't have studied one before.
No, and teachers taught it, say, over two terms, or sometimes a bit longer than two terms, with a slow run through from prehistoric to modern medicine. And they organised it almost as a series of consecutive mini topics. And they thought, because it was on a theme and every topic can link to every other, that the kids would end up with an overview of medicine. And very, very few did from that mode of teaching. And when we look back, you know, we almost kicked ourselves. Because people were looking at the significance of events as they were, or of developments, as they rose on the chronological timeline. And of course, they only have significance once you know the whole story. Otherwise, significance can only be evaluated once they know the whole story. So why this was a turning point, you know, you can't begin to say when you've only, when you're still just stuck in the Renaissance. Because it was only a turning point, not at the time, but in terms of what it led to. And the same is true with the 19th century developments and public health, etc. So it was only when we developed, we worked out what was going on and why we thought what might be the problem, recognizing that if we teach the stuff bit by bit, and we expect the kids to assemble it themselves, we're doing the easy bit, and we expect them to do the hard bit. And what we really needed to do was to teach the whole at one go, very quickly, and then keep on infilling the whole with detail and asking questions about it, and sort of expanding the whole line as we by asking questions about a much simpler whole line, so we make it more and more complicated in that sense. And we did this first with a new study and development, which was energy through time, and that worked very, very much better. And that had a three-fold structure of the original sort of outline. And we had markers of change in terms of significance by using the notion of, well, we looked at various markers, but one was the energy slave. You know, so sort of poor, unaccommodated man at the beginning simply had his or her own muscles, so none. And now, I think the estimates are that each of us on Earth has about 200, the equivalent of 200 slaves. The concept of the energy slave, we only found out after the event. Robert Owen's son had beaten us to it. And in the 19th century, he'd worked out that as a result of industrialization, we had this, he spotted that there was a revolution and that we had mechanical slaves, which amounted to, you know, tens of people per person. So the kids can actually see that all these disparate types of development and event and state of affairs told a story against several markers, of which this was one. And then, you know, the second section, we looked at various factors, so in terms of causal explanation. Again, expanding the whole framework. And then the third section, we looked at the certain problems. You know, why did things need to be invented more than once? You know, we looked at the distinction between trends and turning points. You know, the notion that you know, the shape of the curve, the direction of the curve, changes when you have a turning point. We looked at the distinction between change and progress. You know, that progress is purely a value judgment, and that one person's, you know, jam is usually mixed with another person's blood, and how relativistic that this is. But that the notion of actually the development, the line of development itself, with trends and turning points in it, is not relativistic, not a matter of evaluation. It is. These are patterns which can be observed. So this was a much better way of teaching the study and development.
So as you came to that realisation, that was then fed back to the schools?
Fed back, and also fed back with new materials. So first we feed it back on new ways of using the old materials, and then it was instantiated in new teaching and learning materials themselves. We could do this much more quickly now with everybody being online.
So at that time you had to actually invest in a new print room?
Yeah, So medicine was rewritten after energy, and we went on. So this was what I mean to say, it wasn't simply a launch project, as were some of the other schools council initiatives, which it was, you know, sort of launch, evaluate, disseminate, and that's it. It was launch, evaluate, develop, evaluate, evaluate, develop, and
you only did one official evaluation, didn't you? The one that was published.
Yes. Yeah.
But there was evaluation going on all the time.
Oh yes, saying? We kept when the directorship fell to me for a period of time. That's what we carried on doing.
Mm-hmm. Because you were director from 78 to 82.
Yeah.
So did you take it in a specific direction or seek to do things differently to how David had done them?
No, it's just simply sought to make it, well, did make it, reduce the load in some ways, and make it less ambitious in some ways. For example, by reducing, initially he had three modern world studies, and we cut that down to one.
Because schools had said it was too much? Or?
It was too much, yeah, and we agreed with the schools. And also by introducing new options.
And that was all, was that
that's what I did.
Responsiveness,
yeah,
to the,
yeah,
schools?
Well, also it was not just responding to what they said, it was responding to what they said and we found and when we went and looked. So it wasn't a sort of a marketing relationship of responding to we were in this together.
Yeah. But of course for the
more school, of a partnership.
For the schools,
yeah,
it was the fact that their children would be entering an O-level CSE exam based,
yeah,
on that work. So it must have seemed quite a risk to them.
It was. And some places it was a disastrous move. And you can see that in the exam results. And of course, developing the examination system was also a big part of what we had to do, because we didn't know how to examine it initially. But it was amazing, really, because to get the same grade as on a conventional syllabus, people said, and I think they were right, that the kids had to be a lot further on. It was a lot harder for them to teach, and it was a lot harder for the kids to learn. They did say that they got the benefit in the sense that they had more. We got no formal proof of this except what the schools themselves told us, but they said in general that they got more of the more able kids. The ones would normally have gone for an additional language or an extra science. They realised that history become in their schools, so they said, a much more high status subject. It was being recognised as a thinking subject. So amongst certain kids at any rate, it had the kudos of being hard. And we'd like to think as well that it had the kudos of being interesting and intellectually challenging, but I think there is purely just a badge. If this is hard subjects, then it's considered to be more worthwhile, or it was then, amongst certain kids.
But at the same time, you were saying that what surprised you in the evaluation was that average and below average children
benefited. Yes, this was totally against my own expectations and perhaps prejudices, but we found, this is when we started to look at the kids' ideas and their basic assumptions. This is when we actually spotted in what ways they were benefiting, that they were, because ideas about how and why things happen in human affairs changed, and actually were better, were more advanced than those who were doing modern world studies or socioeconomics.
How How did you measure more advanced? What were your criteria for more advanced?
Well, we actually got, we couldn't actually do formal models of progression in terms of change over time, because we didn't have, we didn't go down far enough. We were dealing with a constant age group. So we're just doing, you know, comparisons. And we did take controls. We took measures of various measures of socioeconomic status. You know, used the Glossop-Sugarman scale. We did AH4 tests, simply to eliminate the effects of IQ, which caused us political problems, but I think you have to do, otherwise you're just going to, you might just end up with comparing a brighter population with a not so bright population. We looked at interest, sex. Those are the main things. Then several second order variables, some of which turned out to be very interesting. But we have all these basic ideas. We do complicated cluster analyses, and we find that they, very many ideas just are manifestations of certain core assumptions, and that certain ideas may link with others, but lots of ideas are never found together, lots of sort of statements. And so we can put these in a directionless hierarchy, such that you can get one cluster of ideas at one end, then another goes next to in a series. It's a value judgment as to which direction this series runs. But once we make those value judgments, if we do make that value judgment, then we can actually say we've got good reason to believe this is a model progression, which we've not simply imposed from the outside, but which is there, emerged from the data, and we can't break it.
I.e. levels of understanding.
Levels of understanding. This is where this came.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it was the SHP that introduced this notion of levels of understanding.
Yeah.
What's been done with it since could make you wish it had never arisen. But that wasn't what was intended or where it came from. And there was absolutely no doubt that when you partial out the effects of, you know, sex and IQ and social background didn't figure as much as we would have thought. We had a school effect, and we had a, which was independent of whether they'd done the project or not, and we also, but we also had a project effect.
Do you think the school effect was linked to the ability of the teacher? You know, just how much they'd understood and developed the thinking in the classroom.
That is a very reasonable, yeah, conjecture, but one that we could not begin to test.
That's really interesting. It shows the difficulty of controlling any sort
absolutely.
Of project.
Absolutely. But, and this is, again, if you like, this is one of the limits you have to say when you say that the that there was a project effect. Of course, you can't distinguish that from the actual school effect, because certain teachers are chosen to do the project and others not. But we did find some very effective, you know, a big range amongst the control schools. But, you know, just to take an example, if you just think of cause, we find that very difficult for kids, particularly in the control group, to move away from the notion of the agency model of cause. So they looked at change, cause and effect in history in the same way that they would look at in terms of intention and action and human affairs. And they would anthropomorphize causes. They would, you know, use these labels like, you know, sort of religion and war, etc., but treat them, the logic of how they worked was exactly the logic of a more powerful person who had the power to do things, make things happen. And they saw events, or causes really, as sort of particularly powerful events, or events that could breed other events. But this was an anthropomorphisation. Whereas, at the top end, and this was rare amongst the control schools, but we had quite a lot with the project schools, they were really wrestling, and we did get quite a few who could distinguish between reasons for action and causes of events, and could see, go even move beyond mechanical causality. I can remember one kid in writing explaining it. A cause is like sort of the, when you come to a road junction, you can go right or you can go left. That's up to you. But you can't go straight on because the situation doesn't let you. And that's how causes work. And this was moving towards possibility thinking, when they actually just saying that how history works, nothing, and solve the problem of, we say that nothing's ever inevitable in history, but we say things are caused. What do causes do if they don't make things happen? Make things have to happen. Now this kid, this could solve this problem. And in terms of what causes do, they don't say X will occur, but they actually open up certain possibilities and close down others. So yes, we've got choice in the future, but we can't choose. We don't have unlimited choice. We don't have free choice. We don't have the fantasy choice. And this is how the past actually impacts upon the present and the future. And this is where the shadow of the past falls. It doesn't give us a definite future, but it limits the sort of futures we can possibly have, which is, I think, for school history, a sophisticated idea and understanding of really why it's important to understand the past.
Did you feel that you were challenging Piagetian ideas about children's capabilities?
Well, very much so. I had a great sort of respect for the Piaget, but first we noticed that what he described as horizontal décalage, same operations, but some were phenomenally more difficult than others. Some was like the difference between stimulus and phenomenal difficulty in assessment items. He just put this down to difficulty of the context, but the operations are the same, and the operations aren't more sophisticated. He'd totally misinterpreted the nature of the discipline, and that actually the operations were far more complicated than the ones that have been compared in, if not directly by Piaget himself or Piaget and Helder, certainly by people like Roy Hallam, who'd followed and applied the Piagetian schemes. It was confirmed that these things were very much stage-related, not age-related. And it would confirm, though, Piaget, in a sense, that these things, acceleration is certainly possible. And we're still finding that. Peter Lee, on the Chatter project, he talked about the 7-year gap, that you can have kids who have got ideas or ahead of the, conceptually, people who are 7 years ahead of them chronologically and going through the school system. Very much we confirm that, but also acceleration is possible. So we're doing now basically on big picture stuff and the relationship between this and the importance of second order concepts there. We have found that in the year 7 kids, quite a few of them can do this possibility thinking, which is really very impressive.
Do you think that if the same sort of skills were developed right across the curriculum, actually children would accelerate more?
Well, I think some of these things are discipline specific, but we did find distinct hints, or more than hints, indications, but we didn't quantify because we couldn't look at what had happened in the science. But we found a lot of kids who had made most progress with the history had been able to make their own contrast between history and science. We also found some who just imported scientific notions into history, or even mathematical ones, when we're dealing with bright kids, who just wanted to reduce, you know, history to some form of complex algebra. And of course it wouldn't work. But it was very useful for them to explore this. But fundamentally, you're absolutely right. It's just how we actually manage this. If every subject is taught as a thinking subject, and you do engage with the logic of all these subjects, and it is certainly very useful for people to break out of their, teachers to break out of their own subject enclaves. I mean, speaking personally, when I was teaching as well as history, simply because of shortage, I taught O-level physics and some O-level and A-level maths, and it was very liberating and thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's a useful thing to do, to teach outside your own subject and to get to know how that these other things work. But perhaps an example, again, if we're dealing with the evidence, the logic of evidence, not the evidence skills, we found even at, say, at the postgraduate PGC level, the graduates, they have great difficulty with, they operate by feel very often. And there's still a sense, or some of them would still think, that when certain sources are consistent, that therefore they corroborate each other, when they don't. And there's even greater difficulty in distinguishing between cases of contrariety and contradiction. So they can spot that there is a disagreement here, or things that don't fit. But the logic of that disagreement, they find it much more difficult to pin down, when it can actually be very precise, and when being precise is necessary to see exactly what you can infer from those sources taken as a set. And, you know, also from being able to see that this doesn't just cause you a problem. The fact that you might have these strange patterns of consistency, corroboration, contrariety, contradiction between the sets, the material, can be exploited, and can itself tell you a great deal that the sources just taken singly don't seem to tell you. And they can get it when it's explained, you know, and they can see how that this can make sense, help to make sense of both, help them to both design tasks and to model tasks with kids. But they always regret that although they'd actually done what are now called dissertations or personal projects and had sort of courses on this, they'd never ever actually been taught the underlying logic of inference.
I don't think I ever have, really. Yes, formally.
Yeah, but
you pick it up, don't you?
You pick it up. You do pick. But this is one of the problems that often these courses, the university courses now, leave people to pick it up. The philosophy of history courses are much far fewer of them. Modules than there used to be, and the number of students will put up their hands, yes, we've done the methodology course, you know, sort of. But when you look at what they've done, it is almost coaching course on just procedures for doing their personal projects. And they don't actually, this is how you do it, and these are the algorithms you follow, and therefore you'll produce an acceptable project. And they don't learn anything, they don't actually grapple with any difficult problems. And the historian should grapple with really difficult problems of, okay, you know, I have these questions. Can these sources of various kinds, record and relic and what have you, give me any answers? And how do I get the right answer? They don't. Anyway, that's perhaps them being a grumpy old man.
Well, it's they're the teachers of the next generation, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, but some, it's a market economy in higher education, and it's a modular system. Has not done us any favours.
It's a sort of coherence of knowledge that you seem to be, a coherence of understanding that you're grieving over, in a sense. Is that what you mean? Modules
yes.
that cut across any coherence.
That's right. And it's also, it's the obsession with the truffle hunting as well. And the truffle seems to get seem to be increasingly these days minute and meretricious. One of the things we didn't really appreciate at the project at the time is now come into fashion as the big picture history. I think this is absolutely right. It was a lesson of the study and development that people can, the bits only make sense in the context of the whole. And that the present is the cutting edge, it's the leading edge of the past. You know, and we're really dealing with, in history teaching, with past, present, future. And that above all, the kids need to be able to construct a story and have the apparatus necessary to use it in a sensible way. Also to evaluate it, to extend it, to elaborate it through time. This is what we pick up and we carry on throughout life out of interest doing, if you like, infilling and elaborating our own big pictures of the past.
Although some people actually form a picture and then never add to it, do they?
They
just read stuff that
learned.
Confirms the picture that they've got.
They haven't, yeah. Well, they haven't learned, yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, true, but that's...
that's the lamentable side of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've got to avoid that. But this is where, in a sense, the link with the second order concepts has come in, because looking at the big picture formation now and why kids find it so difficult, I mean, one obvious thing is that they often generalise from models of the present, which is very small scale, very parochial. And it might work up to a point when they're dealing with little pictures of the past, topic size pictures, you know, sort of King John or Adolf or whatever. But it doesn't work at all when they're dealing with pictures that cross generations, many generations, and where the events are only significant in the sense that they change states of affairs or contribute to trends or turning points. And again, the apparatus of second order concepts, understanding of causation, of change and development, that will work for little pictures, topic sized, doesn't work, it has to be much more sophisticated and complicated when they're dealing with big pictures. And so they don't have the models and they don't have the apparatus to deal with big pictures unless and until this is directly taught. And those second order concepts are, you know, taken a few stages further. And then it is possible, and they can start to do it. But it's hard.
It sounds as if you are still developing the ideas related to school's history project, despite the fact that you said to me it all stopped when we got to GCSE and national curriculum.
Yeah.
So what stopped and what kept going?
Right.
What did you
well,
mean by that?
Yeah. Well, my interest, but well, I was only able to start looking at history again when I moved out of educational management, which is something I wasn't at all fitted
so
for.
So you left SHP in 1982, SCHP then?
Yes.
And then you went into educational management.
Yeah.
So did you not have anything to do with it during those years?
Well, except having a superintending role of you know, the history education as part of everything else. But we had surfeit of historians, and so, you know, I left the teaching of the history to other very good, well, to very good historians, and did other things. But when my final years, I had enough of this and stopped, and I took over the PGC history, studied other things, but then was able to get back into it and make direct contacts with history departments. And working with the Institute of Education on the Framework Working Group now. So this is all done on PNOT funding, but with some very, very good colleagues in school, some excellent people.
Do you think that the development continued in the 80s, despite the fact there were constraints of national curriculum, and the 90s, I should say? Or is SHP just...
It changed. It developed in a sense, but I would not have said it progressed. It almost... people worked to the exams, and the exams became a lot simpler. It had to be, because all the different courses became standardised. And people then also worked to the National Curriculum Programme of Study. And you could say, you know, as you say to a student, tell people, you know, look, this is not exclusive at all. In fact, I could meet all these requirements in half a term and then do something useful. And the law doesn't stop me. And the attainment targets is NCAT, or we'll move down to one. The only time you have to use it is for end of key stage 3 reporting. And you can mercifully forget about it for the rest of the time. But no, you had school managements, deputy heads with personality disorders who insist that every piece of homework, every piece of classwork be levelled against an NCAT. You know, and so you go into school and you see people, things that have been copied off the board have been given a level simply to comply with the system. Well, once you start doing that to teachers, and they've got no, they stopped having any elbow room. I think the ceiling came down. So I would admit that a lot of very bad practice, the worst practice, was really tackled by these developments. But most creativity, I think, stopped. There was a lot of creativity of certain kind.
I mean, there's still a lot of creativity, obviously.
Of a certain kind.
Yes, mm. Of a certain kind, meaning?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it was bright ideas. Not so much was joined up. I mean, it's like sort of what became started off as the Key Stage 3 strategy and then became the secondary strategy, and you have to share objectives and you have to have a starter. Well, you didn't have to have a starter. Not even for maths. They changed that very quickly when they realised how fatuous it was. But you had to go through these particular, and then the plenary. And these, this was a practice which was good in general. But that's the only thing you can ever say about practice, you know, that this is, in general, this is a good idea. Not that this should be done on every single lesson for every single purpose, because very often there are many cases where it's just silly and damaging, not just pointless. And you see starters that took up, that was wasted 10 minutes of the lesson. And I've seen starters which had no connection with the main point of the lesson. And so it was just, you know, we'll do something fun, interesting. Okay, now we'll start the lesson. And you've just wasted 10 minutes in effect. And it isn't because, this is because teachers have been forced into a straitjacket and not allowed to use their own discretion. And you can't blame them. Therefore, if I've got to, oh God, I've got to have a starter. And so they just go to one of the books that have all these ready-made starters and just pick one. And they're complying with the requirements.
So you've lost
the You've lost a lot.
Yeah.
You've lost the key. But you also, in a sense, lose the point. You stop people thinking. Mm-hmm. Mind you, I am really, I'm sorry, I'm sounding like a grumpy old man.
So are you still involved with the postgraduate history education?
No, I retired in advanced age in 07, the end of that year. So I've come back just to do bits, and I think I'll do the research masters this autumn.
Can I just ask, you mentioned you were involved in the Cambridge A-Level History Project.
Yeah, Peter Lee and I, we were the co-directors of this.
What years was that operating from?
Now then. This would be, I have to check with Peter. This would be about 1981 to perhaps 87. Then it just carried on.
So is it still offered today?
No, it about 4 years ago, it fell victim to the rationalisation and decided to drop it because it couldn't meet the new criteria.
Did
it was
never
very
became,
different.
It never became as popular as the
no,
SHP.
It didn't.
Why do you? Because obviously it's a similar sort of idea.
Yeah.
But a slightly more advanced level.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we got it wrong in some ways. So the idea was that we'd have a depth study, which was located within a developmental study. And the depth study we started with, although there was a, it moved on to two syllabuses, because we had technology one as well as the politics, people power and politics. And the depth study was focused for the people power and politics, which was the lead one, was focused on the Civil War. And essentially, you know, we had a big key question, was there an English Revolution? And you could get one sort of answer to that if you just studied the actual period. That was informed. We had a comparative study. We moved into looking at the front. And some stuff on the general crisis of the 17th century. You know, and the idea was that you had all these very similar things happening all over Europe, in the United Provinces, even in Iberia and North Italy. And there was no perceptible links between them. And so why? You know, and therefore, we're getting the kids to challenge, okay, just by looking at an English context or a British context, because of course it was a four-nation thing, you could come to some sort of answer as to what was going on here. But then we wanted them to look to say, well, how adequate is that when the same sort of things seem to be happening elsewhere over and over again, where the conditions were really rather different. And you certainly couldn't put all these things down to the bad luck of having a particularly foolish and intransigent king on the throne at a given time. But also, you got a different answer again if you looked at the long view. And so looking again at scalar effects, you know, if you said an answer to the question, was there an English Revolution? If you just looked at 1642 to 1649, you might get one answer. 1642 to 1659, another answer. If you look at 1603 to 1688, perhaps another answer. And you go to 1704, another answer, and so on. And that the whole notion of a revolution, therefore, you're asking different questions as soon as you actually change the time scale. And therefore, it isn't, these judgments are not simply something to do with the properties of the particular events within a very circumscribed time period, you know, as we do with the French Revolution starting in 1789, lasted until the Directorate, you know, then. That was the idea. And then also then a big section on sort of the methodology, looking at accounts. So not just sources and evidence, but this rather much more metaphysical, epistemological concept of the relationship of an historical account to the past and the purposes it serves. But we discussed all this with, we planned all this with, you know, French teachers. One of the interesting things that came out, which was personally very gratifying, was that colleagues were quite happy, yes, we're going to look at answering the question, you know, how do we know, and evidence and accounts. We're going to look at the narrative logic of change and development. We're going to look at explanation, ranging intention, explanation, causal, and empathetic. But we've got concepts and we've got skills. And so we had six domains. We worked out levels. And for a few years, we ran with this. And there was a big, we assessed on two papers and coursework and combined, and we could inform all those domains. We got sufficient data to do multi-trail, multi-method matrix. And the Cambridge Syndicate has these data because they were pleased with them. It was pleased with them. And we did find, yes, we did find three clear domains when we looked at the, how do we know, the narrative, the explanation. We were assessing different things. But it was a complete fold over on the concepts and skills. We could not distinguish between, or thought we were assessing a concept and thought we were assessing a skill. So the six domains on the multi-trained, multi-method matrix boiled down to three. And that's what we moved to then. And so the whole thing went down to three domains, which simplified procedures, and we lost absolutely nothing. So thinking you're assessing a skill in practical terms, and we got independent data for these assessments, it gave exactly the same result, not distinguishable, which is still, never wrote it up though, because we were too busy.
Perhaps shows sometimes it's good to be simple, to have the simplest
absolutely
approach.
Yeah. But at least we started, because this is what colleagues wanted.
But some of those ideas have been absorbed into the new style of A-levels, haven't they?
Yeah.
The study in depth, for instance, that sort of thing. But it didn't actually become as popular as SHP. Why do you think that was?
It was, in a sense, set down to the economics. The Cambridge Syndicate at that time, while it was launched, was still very much an educational charity, and it was willing to pour an enormous amount of money into this. And the exam, it supported, but it was more than twice as expensive to run per candidate as a conventional A level. And so when it moved, when Ockles started to move into OCR, they deliberately wanted to restrict the entry simply because they didn't want to lose too much money, which it was very good of them really in that world to keep it going at all. And this was a fault of ours, because when we designed all this, we were focusing upon what sort of assessment was necessary, and the actual processes of marking and moderation were horrendously expensive to get this right. And we didn't actually think for a minute about the cost. And under Ockles, they were far too gentlemanly and all worldly at Cambridge, at Hills Road, to tell us about this, or to insist. And it was only when the world began to change that the pressure started to come.
That wouldn't happen today, would it?
No, not a chance.
I just wanted to finish off by...
it was our fault.
Yeah, I just wanted to quote from your evaluation. You speak of the very real possibility of a revolution in history teaching. That's your own phrase.
Yeah.
Has it happened?
I think probably. Not the revolutionists had in mind. it's been a revolution from above.
But some of it responding to...
It had an impact, it had an influence. But it was, as with the notion of levels, which came out of SHP, levels of understanding, what was being done with that has been not good. And the fact that you've had these NCATs, which are not based on any empirical evidence whatsoever, but just seem to spring like a deformed Athena from the head of all the stupid Zeus. That all the hallmarks have been designed by apparatchiks, not people who knew anything about it.
Are you happy to finish there?
Yeah, absolutely.